So good morning, and it is the first morning of our retreat, and if we were doing a retreat in person at a retreat centre, everybody would have been arriving yesterday, probably had a little bit of an unsettled night in unfamiliar places, maybe not quite have arrived in the morning. And that can still happen even if we haven't had that travelling, even if we're in our normal place, because there's that transition from our everyday life and activities into being in more of a sort of like retreat mode. But just notice where you are with that, and that is part of the process of being on a retreat, that it all takes us time to arrive and to engage, and at different times different things will be going on for us. Maybe sometimes it's challenging, maybe sometimes it's just really exciting and joyful, but probably along the way we will all experience some bumps, and try and be open to that as part of the process, and also just see how our energy is, how that changes over the days of this retreat. So I'm going to be introducing the first of the tantric precepts, where we undertake not to obstruct the energy of others. But I thought it would be good first to put it in context of the traditional first precept. And then I'm going to be doing some sharing some random thoughts and things that have occurred to me along the way. So the first precept is, I undertake to abstain from taking life. That's the traditional precept that's chanted all around the world. Pana, Tipatava, Remini, Sikapadang, Samadhiyami. In Tri Ratna we also have a sort of positive version of that. A statement to go alongside what we're trying not to do, what we are trying to cultivate, what we're trying to bring more into being. And that's, with deeds of loving kindness, I purify my body. So, not blocking the energy of others may seem a little bit different to not taking a life, you know, particularly in terms of if you have a scale, you know, blocking somebody's energy is probably not the equivalent of taking someone's life. But again, we don't want to be too literal with the teachings or with the precept, because that first precept is really about non-harm, yeah, not harming living beings. And obviously taking life is the most extreme way we can harm a living being. But I think most people would interpret the first precept as being one about non-harm, you know, trying not to harm. And that requires us behaving in skillful, ethical ways. Very opening verses of the Dhammapada, you know, where it's talking about everything in a way being led by mind, preceded by mind, of mind are they made. Well, there's another translation, you know, what we are today comes from our thoughts of yesterday, and our present thoughts build our life of tomorrow. Our life is the creation of our mind. They then go on to say that if one acts, you know, with a mind, you know, a positive mind, a skillful, we act in ways that are caring and helpful and beneficial to others, it will have positive effects, you know, karma, actions have consequences. So it's not to say that everything that happens to us or that we experience is the fruits of past actions and karma, but what it does mean is that the actions that we do, or maybe when we don't act, that has consequences. And depending on, you know, how skillful, how ethical we're behaving, it will either have beneficial consequences for us and others, or it'll have harmful consequences for us and others. So implicit in that first precept about undertaking to abstain from taking life, abstaining from harming living beings, and that includes ourselves, there is, you know, it's implicit in that is that our actions are important, and therefore if we have that as a guideline underlying our actions, that we don't want to harm, we don't want to take life, that's going to have more beneficial effects on us. And it doesn't mean to say that we're not going to fall short a lot. Until we're actually enlightened, we will be driven by the root poisons of greed, hatred, delusion. But our practice is all about, in a way, loosening those influences and seeing if we can transform them. And we can do it drip by drip, little by little. And then we step back, look, and we see that we've made progress. But we can't necessarily know at the time what are the consequences of our actions. Sometimes it bears fruit immediately, sometimes a long way down the line. Sometimes it's more obvious in our external lives, other times more in our internal lives and our states of mind and things like that. So I thought it would be good to have that as the basis before we look at the undertake not to obstruct the energy of others. And I think actually if we take on board that in the traditional version, it's not just harming or taking others' lives, it would also be seen as unskillful doing that to ourselves, that also in this precept we're undertaking to try not to block the energy of others, but that also I think should include us not blocking our own energy or trying to unblock it, trying to free it, because it will be blocked in various ways. So why would it be harmful to block people's energy or our own energy? Well, I think we've probably all experienced having people blocking our energy, not allowing ourselves to be who we are, or not allowing all of ourselves to be accepted, allowed, and how difficult, how harmful that can be, you know. The conditions that we grow up with in our families, schools, society, work, around peer groups, that often does limit, restrict how we feel we can be or present ourselves or live, and we make choices based on that. And it can be quite undermining, can't it? And we can find ourselves cut off from what's most important, what's most meaningful to us. We can end up sort of burying parts of ourselves, shutting down our creativity, our spontaneity, which to my mind is harmful. And we can do that to others as well. You know, especially if somebody, there's something that's important to them, or they've just got a germ of something that's creative and it might not be really formed, it's very easy to just come down and, you know, be dismissive of it, or to sort of think of all the reasons why it won't work without allowing them to sort of like fully develop that idea or that aspect of themselves that just gets cut off at the root, so to speak. And that can be very painful, and if that happens to us a lot, then we can end up feeling there's no point in trying to, you know, develop our potential, or we may actually believe we don't have potential, or that we're not creative and we don't have all these qualities and spiritual qualities. You know, it may make us doubt our being, that we're good enough, that we're okay. And I think it's really interesting that in Buddhism, we don't have the idea of original sin, but we have that idea of original purity, and that we have Buddha nature, that we all have Buddha nature. And in a way, it's less about trying to create something and make ourselves different, but it's more like uncovering clearing away the things that block us from realizing that potential, from seeing our own Buddha nature. Just a pause there. So energy. There's so many different kinds of energy, so many different ways that we experience energy. We're beings of energy, and there's energy out around us in the world. And we are part of the world, and we are part of a whole cycle of life and connection and interconnection with the Earth, the planet Earth, and all the growing things, all the living beings. And we all, in a way, participate in the world, and we're sort of sharing energy, exchanging energy. You know, we need light and warmth of the sun to live. We also need all the things that grow that we can eat, you know, fruit and vegetables. Maybe we also, I mean, sometimes eat living beings. I mean, from a Buddhist point of view, we're trying not to harm, and that might not yet be something that we've able to let go of, even if it may be an aspiration, so we may still be doing that. But there's something about, you know, and when we die and our body is rotten, that creates all kinds of nutrients for the soil where other things can grow. So we are part of that cycle of life. And I think it's quite interesting, we use the analogy of seeds a lot in Buddhism, and growing things. And a seed is, in a way, contained energy, isn't it? And potential energy in this, well, some seeds are really big, most of them aren't that big, some of them can be really tiny. But it has that potential for life, that potential for growth. And if you give it the right conditions, you know, the sun, the soil, the light, the water, the right kind of soil, and if you kind of protect it from the things that would otherwise strangle it, like the weeds, or, you know, it doesn't get eaten by other living creatures, then that will grow, and it can grow into all kinds, you know. Well, it can only grow into whatever kind of seed it is, which I think is also interesting as an analogy, because we can't make ourselves into a different kind of person than we are. I mean, we can develop different sides of ourselves, we can suppress different sides of ourselves, we can present ourselves in different ways. You know, we can choose which parts of ourselves that we put energy into and grow and develop, and which parts we don't. But we can't make ourselves into anything other than we are. You know, I can't make myself into Prajnanita. You know, I can't make myself into the Dalai Lama. I can't make myself even into someone that I admire. You know, if I wanted to be a wonderful writer or composer, dancer. I mean, Prajnanita's a martial artist. There's absolutely no way that I can do that, you know. And if I tried to make myself, well, I suppose if I spent years and years and years doing it in the past, I might have been able to, because I suppose we probably do have potential to develop various things. But I suppose what I'm saying is that we all have our own intrinsic nature, and we can grow in our own way, and we can help others to grow in their way. Yeah. So I think this whole thing about blocking energy is sometimes people try to stop us growing into the particular being or plant or flowering in the way that, you know, naturally we would. And sometimes we can get in the way of other people doing that as well. And I think that's partly because we like to be in control, and the part of us that likes to be in control is coming very much from our thinking mind and our ego and our sense of identity that can get quite fixed and then not like change and feel threatened by others, and that can then very much try to control our own growth, development, what we do with our energy, and also others. So that's interesting that there's also a lot of imagery and text talking about freeing the mind, freeing the heart, liberating the mind, the heart. Enlightenment very much portrayed as a state of complete freedom and spontaneity, where, you know, if we were an enlightened being, we wouldn't be restricted in any kind of way. There'd be that free-flowing energy, compassion, wisdom, and those three things being seen as the really key parts of enlightenment or awakening experience: energy, compassion, and wisdom. And of course, they're all interlinked, and as we're developing one, we're developing the others, and we need all of the others to help develop any one aspect. And I think we know what it's like when we've been restricted, when we have blocked some aspect of ourselves, not allowed ourselves to experience something, even if it's difficult, even if it's painful, when we actually allow ourselves to turn towards it, sit with it, something is released, something becomes more open, and then there is more energy that can be used in other ways. It can be a sense of freedom, even if it may be bittersweet at the time. And sometimes it feels really joyful. Yeah. So it's useful to be more mindful of how we are in our interactions with each other. And all our actions, in a way, are an expression of our energy, whether those are actions of body, speech, and mind. And if we're not acting, that's also an expression of not using that energy. And bringing more awareness to that can be helpful. I mean, in a way, the path is all about awareness, cultivating compassion. And I'm thinking quite a lot actually about both the hindrances, the so-called hindrances, and also the awakening or enlightenment factors, because I think those are all kind of quite closely linked to energy and use of energy, or particular qualities of energy. So you're probably more familiar with the hindrances than the enlightenment factors, but I'm going to just sort of mention what they all are. So the hindrances, well, we've got craving for sense experience or sense desire. So anything, you know, whether it's a sight, smell, sound, taste, whether it's sex, also whether it's for like mental stimulation, because from a Buddhist point of view, the mind is also a sense organ. All of those are aspects of us wanting something, wanting a particular experience, craving a particular experience. And we experience it through the body, and there's going to be a sort of like sense experience here. And it's interesting because we're always trying to get more aware of our body, more embodied, because that grounds us and stops us just being in our head. And because, in a way, the body is the vehicle in which we experience the world, in which we connect with, interconnect with the world and with others. You've got ill will or aversion and hatred, which are the other side of craving. In fact, in a way, it's also craving, but in, as you know, in the root poison, we talk about attachment, greed, and craving in a kind of grouping. And it's sort of like, well, the things that you crave that you want, maybe you don't have them and you want to get them, or maybe you've already got them and you want to hold on to them. Ill will or aversion is sort of flipping it on the other side about, well, what we don't want to experience, and what we don't want to have in our lives, and the things that we, you know, we find unpleasant, so we want to push away or ignore or bury. But that's another craving. It's just craving for things to be different to the way they are, you know, and not to be in the, you know, there's a craving for it to be a certain way, maybe fix the world in the way that we want it to be, and there's also that craving for it not to be how it is, which is also just that seen from a different emphasis in a way, you know. And they're coming from that root delusion or view of ourselves as a separate being, in the way that we kind of cling to our sense of ourselves and our ego and all those splits about me and you, us and them, in and out of all the dualities, come in a way from that root delusion of ourselves as being separate from others and having this fixed, unchanging self. But anyway, that's not one of the hindrances, but it's under, basically all the hindrances are under, what underlies all the hindrances are those three things, and the hindrances are expressions of those in our lives and in our meditation. So you've got the sloth and torpor, which we probably experience as a lack of energy, whether it's physical energy, emotional energy, or mental energy. And sometimes that may be not exactly sloth and torpor, but just that we're exhausted and tired, or we have limited energy, or we're, you know. But it can sometimes also be because we don't want to experience something and we kind of block it and shut down. You know, even unconsciously we may do that. Suddenly we're really tired, or we just don't have the energy to just stay with something, continue with it, even though that might lead to quite a significant breakthrough. That's probably the time when you might decide you just don't have the energy for it. You know, we've got the restlessness and anxiety, so the restlessness of our body and mind. And we've also got doubt and indecision. Sometimes people talk about uncertainty, but for me, actually, uncertainty is quite a positive state, because you're more open, maybe, to discovering what's there rather than fixed in a view. But when we're indecisive and when we've got a lot of doubt, whether it's doubt of ourselves or others or Dharma, then that can really undermine our confidence and our practice and us being able to grow and develop. So those all get expressed in a way through mental states, emotional states, and then we act on them or don't act on them in our lives. So they are very closely linked with action and energy and ethical practice. And on the other side, and these are, it's interesting because people often don't talk about the awakening factors or the dhyana factors, enlightenment factors, when one first comes along. And you could be practicing for quite a long time and never come across them. Unless you happen to decide you want to explore something like the Satipatthana Sutta, where it goes into them quite a lot. But anyway, they are all seen as practices, you know, so there's, you know, what it would be like when it's fully developed, you know, if we were an awakened, enlightened being. But as with everything else, there's where we are now, and we start where we are now and then hopefully grow and develop something along the way. And they are seen as practices that, in a way, help to work with the hindrances, loosen the effect of the hindrances, in a way, transform the hindrances, because they've all got positive potential. So, well, mindfulness is the first one, and it's, in a way, it's a foundation. You know, if we establish mindfulness, then all the others are likely to develop, and it's very hard to develop them without mindfulness. So in a way, the fact that we tend to focus very much on mindfulness when we start and then throughout our practice makes sense. It's seen that when we're establishing mindfulness, then insight and wisdom are much more likely to develop. But we can be, right from the start, consciously cultivating them and consciously cultivating wisdom. And there's something about when we see something with clearly, or we see through a view, see through our conditioning, that then we're more able to let go, and that can free up our energy, and then we can think, well, make a choice if we continue the same way, if we want to make changes, so we can direct our energy in pursuit of our, you know, spiritual growth, or in a way just allow ourselves to be with what is, and that process to happen. Going back to the seeds again, you can't force the rate of growth of a seed or a plant. It will grow at its own rate, and sometimes that will take a long, long time, and sometimes it will happen really quickly. I actually managed to grow some purple sprouting broccoli last year, but I planted them, what did I plant? I think it took about a year and a half for them actually to grow any broccoli, and I'd kind of like given up on it, you know. Whereas if you grow, you know, some lettuces and things, they might start growing within a week. So in a way, you have to just let go and trust that you're planting the seeds, you're creating the conditions, and things will fruit and grow at their own pace, in their own way. But we can sort of like create those conditions by cultivating some of these factors, you know. So you've got your mindfulness, and then there's the idea of investigation, or investigation of dharmas. So dharma has a lot of different ways it's translated, you know, dharma with a big D, truth, reality, the teachings, practices of the Buddha that help us to gain enlightenment. But it's also, especially when you see it with a little d, it's in a way every well, anything really. It sort of manifests, anything is seen as a manifestation of reality. So, you know, what's happening in our minds, what's happening in the world around us, those can all be seen as dharmas. So when we're investigating dharmas, in a way we're sort of probably looking at what's arising in our experience, conditionality around us and within us. And as we see that things arise, what are the conditions that help things to arise, that help things to develop and stay or to end, and we can actively try and create more positive conditions, or maybe move away from conditions that aren't, or just in a way hold in awareness, well, this is what happens, you know. And that includes all the sort of mental states that we might be experiencing, or the emotional states that we might be experiencing. And it leads to clarity, really. Clarity and choice, and some of that may be realizing that what we might have taken as fact or believed about ourselves and others in the world might not actually be true, and getting more of a dharmic perspective, you know, being aware of things like impermanence and dukkha. And if we do have more awareness of that, then we might not waste a lot of energy in trying to fix everything. You know, we can't actually get rid of dukkha. We might be able to change certain forms of dukkha that we're experiencing and create different conditions, but actually, whatever we're doing, so much of what is around us is outside of our control, and dukkha is just one of the aspects of living in this world, one of the conditioned things. Yeah. So is impermanence. You know, we can't we can't stop things changing. You know, and some of that impermanence may be positive, and some of it we might find difficult. You know, and again, we waste a lot of energy in trying to stop things. Yeah, if we don't like them, if they're unpleasant, or we can put a lot of energy into trying to block them. And if they're things that we really like, we can put a lot of energy in trying to keep hold of them. But either way, at some point, you know, we're not going to succeed. So if we actually embrace the idea of impermanence and dukkha and stop fighting it, stop resisting it, that frees up so much more energy that we can actually do into, you know, following our dreams, you know, creating the conditions for more positive experiences in our lives, or working with the things that get in the way, uncovering, unblocking the things that get in the way of us being who we could be in all our Buddha nature. And all this work, and you know, it takes a lot of energy, doesn't it? It takes determination, takes energy, and different kinds of energy. So it's interesting that one of the tantric precepts is about using appropriate energy for whatever it is that you're trying to do, in a way, whatever purpose you've got. Because sometimes you need quite a lot of directed, forceful, active energy, and sometimes you might need to be really receptive and calm and still. They're both ways of working with energy. Yeah. And there's the, you know, energy of actively doing things with our bodies, but there's also the energy when we're turning within and we're being with our experience in different ways. And that you need some kind of continuity, you know, to carry on the path, because it is going to be hard. There will be times it's challenging. And there will be times when we might not feel up to it. Yeah. So energy, and particularly energy in pursuit of, well, it's sometimes, virya is sometimes translated as energy in pursuit of the good. But yeah, that is definitely a quality that is really helpful. And I think that works very well against both restlessness and anxiety and sloth and torpor. As I think the investigation of dharmas and being more aware of things like impermanence and dukkha help with the craving and the ill will. And then we've got joy as an enlightened factor. And joy can arise out of our practice. It doesn't have to be this state of mind all the time, but we may actually find that we're much more happy, much more content, we experience more joy, we're more open to joy as a result of our practice. And joy, in a way, is an energy. You know, we probably all know the feel, the quality of when we are feeling joyful. It does feel very positive, isn't it? So that's one of the things that we might be trying to hold on to, rather than just, you know, allow ourselves to be open, receptive, surprised by joy, to really allow ourselves to experience it fully, and just knowing that, yes, it arises sometimes and then it all pass away, but then it can arise again. Yeah. But often when we have those insights, or we make a positive change, or we release blocked energy, we may spontaneously have an experience of joy. And the next one is tranquility, or quietness of mind. So it can also be really pleasant, but it's not as, you know, maybe as big or as intense an experience, but there's something quite subtle and quite beautiful sometimes about being in a really tranquil, quiet state of mind. And we've got concentration. So I think when I first started out, for me, concentration had all the sort of connotations of how I'd tried to concentrate in my life up till then, and it was quite a forced thing. And you must concentrate when you didn't necessarily want to concentrate, and it's really hard to concentrate on something that either you didn't understand or weren't interested in. And it was really sort of like forcing attention, and there was a limit to how long you could do it. So in this state, I think it's much more about a state of absorption, where we become more and more concentrated. And it's not force, it comes maybe initially from just being interested. And then if there is enjoyment, then we get much more absorbed, in that experience. And when we are in a very concentrated state of mind and we don't have distractions, we're not resisting things, we're not pushing things away, and we're not craving things. It is actually a very pleasant state of mind to be in, or it can be. And also from there, we can have that experience of equanimity. So equanimity, as an enlightenment factor, it's very much a flowering of metta, so it's coming from a place of kindness and love and compassion and joy. So, if you're familiar with the Varmaviharas of which are basically kindness, compassion, joy, or sympathetic joy, gladness, and then you have equanimity, and equanimity embodies all of the others, and it also has a very conscious insight aspect where you're aware of reality. You are aware of conditions, you are aware of things like dukkha, impermanence, insubstantiality, and also you can see actions having consequences for yourself and for others. So that not everything that you're experiencing is as a result of your actions, but you can see maybe how you have contributed towards certain things, whether they're positive states or negative states, or things that then are manifested in your life, that sometimes we create conditions that may be positive or maybe challenging, maybe creative, maybe destructive, and we often do play a role in that, partly because of our conditioning and our views, which may or may not be conscious, but certainly I'm very aware of how so much of the things that I experienced in my past, even if I think I've worked through them, they affect how I react to what's happening now. And particularly if I'm stressed out, I may just go right back into some really early, really unhelpful, really destructive reactions, and then find myself, oh, I've created this really messy situation, or I've caused harm to myself or maybe to others, and I didn't mean to do it, but that's just been as a result of not having, that awareness, not having seen through it really. And when we're in a state of equanimity, we're not, there's a sense of being really rooted, really grounded, a sense of almost like an unshakable positivity. And whatever's happening, we're not getting blown by the worldly winds, and there's something in that that is also, for me, closely linked to energy. Not getting blown away by this particular energy, not being attracted by that particular energy, or not kind of like dissipating my energy or losing my energy, or expressing it in unskillful, unhelpful, harmful ways. So I think I've gone a little bit off topic, but it's hard with all of this stuff, isn't it? Everything kind of links in, and you can go down a little route. But yeah, so I think there's something about being aware of our own and others' energy. One of the things I found hard about Zoom actually is having all these meetings on Zoom where you can see somebody, but you don't pick up all the energy that you would if you're in the room with them. We we do pick up all kinds of energies. You know, Paramahansa was talking on the last retreat about how the heart picks up electrical energies as well as other things. But I think we are very sensitive sometimes to the energy, and so much of our communication may be unspoken. And yet if we're on Zoom on a device, we can't pick up that. And then it makes it really hard for certain kinds of communication, or to realise what might be going on for somebody, or what might be going on for you in relation to them, because there isn't that kind of flow or interaction of energy. And I think we can also be very sensitive to any kind of disjunction between what people are saying and the energy behind the words, or the lack of energy behind the words. You know, they're saying, oh, you know, I love you so much, and you can feel the sort of like lack of energy there. You pick that up, can't you? You know, if somebody's being very critical, but you can feel there's a lot of care, concern coming from there, that's very different, isn't it, for someone who might just say something not half as critical, but you can feel that critical energy coming behind it. So I suppose I'm just going to invite everyone to be a bit more aware of energy, and also if you notice yourself blocking your own energy or someone else's energy, sometimes in subtle ways, sometimes in not so subtle ways, and just realizing that that can actually cause harm. Whereas if you can be open, if you can be receptive, if you can allow people to be who they are, if you can witness them, if you can see them, if you can really hear them and give them the space to do that, then that allows, you know, for the energy to grow, develop and to flow. You know, if you're just not interested, or you just don't want to hear, just shut them down, that is a way of blocking people's energy sometimes. Which isn't to say that we should have no boundaries and never sort of say no, but sort of like being a bit more aware about how we do that, doing that more skillfully, you know, rather than just out of our likes and dislikes and our, you know, underlying reaction. So, yeah, just being open to everybody growing and developing into whatever plant they are. Like the Buddha's vision in the White Lotus Sutra, where he talks about, you know, the rain of the Dharma, and like Buddha's, you know, and the sun shining down on all beings, and they grow into all the different kinds of plants that they are. You know, it might be a creeper, it might be a tree, it might be a flower, it might be a lotus. But each will grow according to its own way if it's given the right conditions. So maybe we're trying to create conditions where everybody can grow and develop into whoever they are, and not block that process if we can avoid doing that. Okay, so I'm going to stop there. And let's just have 5 minutes of just sitting, seeing what might arise from that, if anything touched you or particularly resonated. Not necessarily thinking about it, but just noticing. And as Pragyanita invited us to this morning in the meditation, taking ourselves in. Sound is another form of energy. Sound waves. Had some physical energy to actually ring the bell. And I guess there was mental energy that was converted into words and sounds when I was talking earlier. So they say energy can't be destroyed, just only changed or transformed, isn't it? So, we're going to now have a period in groups for those people who want to be in groups. And if you don't want to be in a group, we can put you in a waiting room and then bring you back when the groups are over. And the groups will be for about 25 minutes. So just before we do the groups, you know, I know probably most or all of you will have been in groups many times in different contexts and also on retreats, maybe on some of our retreats. But it's an open space, it's a potential space where you can connect and you can share your experience, you know, and that may be experience, you know, during the retreat or a particular meditation or in response to something we've done. It may be, you know, your general practice or your life. But I would try and keep it focused because you don't have a lot of time. But what I would ask is that in the groups, we are not blocking each other's energy or not trying to redirect people's energy. So if someone's speaking, just don't interrupt. Don't ask them questions. And after they've spoken, don't give them advice. Just witness. Yeah, just listen. It's such a gift to be seen and heard. So can we do that for ourselves? Can we create those conditions for each other? Mindful and compassionate listening. And maybe joy will arise. Who knows? But it is also like an exchange of energy between you, you know. And some of that energy may be more active, some of it may be more quiet. So just also being sensitive to each other's energy. Okay, so Patricia will invite everybody, and if you want to be in a group, just say yes. Okay, so we've only got 20 minutes now. And we're going to be having a period of chanting and partly as an exploration of the actual experience of chanting in our bodies and the energy required to chant and the energy we experience chanting and maybe if there's energy freed up through chanting. We will be doing meditation and ritual in the afternoon session. So this will be mostly chanting. Now normally when we chant a mantra. But we're going to play a little bit and we're going to be chanting some seed syllables, which you may have come across the concept. I've never kind of quite worked out what they are. Well, they're sort of supposed to be like complete, I suppose, very condensed expressions or symbols of enlightenment through sound, and they also have loads and loads and loads of correspondences, but you don't need to know any of that. But for instance, whenever we salute the three jewels, you know, we salute the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, and then we end by going Om Ah Hung, which basically correspond with body, speech and mind, you know, and we're supposed to be practicing, our actions are all of body, speech and mind, our ethical practices of body, speech and mind, our spiritual practice is of body, speech and mind. So we're going to actually have a go at chanting each of those syllables in turn and then do the three as a sort of sequence. Yeah. So I'll start us off chanting one and then just join in. I think you all are muted. You probably know that with Zoom everybody's speed of connection is different, so it doesn't really work if we're all doing it unmuted. But I'll start off with om, and then when that fades away, we'll do ah. When that fades away, we'll do hung, and then we'll do om, ah, hung a few times, yeah? And just choose your own pitch. But it's worth actually going for it rather than just mumbling, because otherwise you won't have that experience much of the energy. It probably won't have as much effect on your body. And just remember, no one can hear you, so don't worry about that. Om. 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 Om.
Ah, 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 ah.
Om So I'll leave you with a short poem by John O'Donohue. And since it's so short, I'll do it twice, I think. I would love to live like a river flows, carried by the surprise of its own unfolding. I would love to live like a river flows, carried by the surprise of its own unfolding. And we'll just sit for 2 or 3 minutes, quietly, collectively. So we'll end the session there. Thank you all for coming. And do come back at 4 for meditation and ritual. And do come back at 7 when Pranyanita will be giving a talk on the second of the tantric precepts around not draining the energy of others and giving freely of our own energy. And there will also be some practice in that session. In the meantime, have a good afternoon, however you spend it. And see if you can use whatever energy is appropriate to whatever activities you're doing. And if you want to unmute and say goodbye, feel free to do that or put anything in the chat.